Submitted. We'll hear argument next in 91615, Allied Signal, Inc. versus the Director of the Division of Taxation. Spectators are admonished, do not talk while you're in the courtroom. The court remains in session. Mr. Fry, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This case is here on petition for writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court of New Jersey to decide the question whether New Jersey has the constitutional right to tax an apportioned share of the capital gain earned by the Bendix Corporation from an investment that it had in a company called Asarco between 1978 and 1981. Bendix was a company at this time that operated various types of businesses, aerospace, automotive, and other. It had four operating groups. These businesses were operated in New Jersey and elsewhere around the United States. In 1978, the chairman of Bendix, reviewing its broad financial interests, determined that it would be prudent to invest a substantial sum of money in Asarco, which is a copper and non-ferrous metals mining and refining company. It's undisputed that the business of Asarco had nothing to do with the businesses in which Bendix was engaged. And about $127 million was used to purchase approximately a little over 20% of the stock of Asarco. 2 years later, in 1980, the chairman of Bendix decided that they'd had a very nice profit in the Asarco stock. It was an excellent investment. He didn't think that natural resources were going to continue to grow and be as profitable in the future as they had been during the period that they'd held the stock. He thought it would be a good idea to concentrate the company's resources more in high-tech areas closer to where it was already operating, and the Asarco stock was sold. A very substantial profit was made.
Mr. Fry, I take it Asarco may also be a New Jersey company?
Asarco is a company that also does business in part in New Jersey, yes.
Not incorporated there, but does business.
I think it actually may have been incorporated there, but there's no question that Asarco...
Does that make any difference?
No, I don't believe it makes any difference. Asarco is taxed on its income in light of the places in which it does business, and if it did business in New Jersey taxed that income. We're now talking about the right to tax Bendix's intangible income from its...
Made any difference?
Well, there is a different theory which
I... investment is made is also a New Jersey company.
There is a completely different theory of measuring the taxation, which I believe New York uses, where you look at not where the taxpayer is operating, but where the companies in which it has invested is operating. That is not the basis of the decision below. That would produce a completely different measurement. I don't know what it is. And I think it is not material to what the court has to decide today. That Asarco did or did not do business in New Jersey.
Do we have this case on the understanding that the investment by Bendix in Asarco was a means of handling some of their working capital for a period of time?
Definitely not. There's no suggestion that that is true here. That would be completely untenable mm-hmm. on the stipulated record in this case. Mm-hmm. Working capital is the capital that is employed in the day-to-day or week-to-week mm-hmm. current operations of a company. It is like the money you need to cover the period when your expenses may exceed your revenues for a temporary period. We're talking here about drawing on what I would call investment capital resources in Bendix and investing it somewhere where Bendix thought it would be profitable. Now, the question ultimately is whether that investment and the income from that investment is part of the business that Bendix was conducting in New Jersey or not part of the business that Bendix was conducting in New Jersey. And if it was not, New Jersey can't tax it. Now, the nexus requirement, which is what we're talking about here, did New Jersey have nexus to tax the profit that Bendix made in the ASARCO investment? Has two pieces. The first piece is sort of the personal jurisdictional element, like was involved in the Quill case. That is, was Bendix in New Jersey to be subject to any taxation by New Jersey? And the answer to that is clearly yes. There's a second part, however, which is well recognized, deeply rooted, goes back to sort of one of the earliest principles of 14th Amendment due process jurisprudence, which is the transaction that is being taxed must have a connection with the taxing state. That is, the state may tax a transaction only if it provides opportunities, benefits, or protection to the activity that it is taxing. Now, the problem in applying this test, which the court has often stated, comes up when you have a multi-state business engaging in a variety of activities in a number of states, and you try to decide what parts of the activities of that business are taxable in the state, and how do you measure a fair amount of tax. Now, the court, in dealing with this, has developed two concepts. One is the concept of apportionment, which asks how you measure how much of the total income of a business may be taxed in a particular state. And the second is a concept which has normally been captured in the idea of the unitary business, that is, identifying what is the business that is being conducted in part in the state that is trying to tax the income. Now, somebody might ask, and I think Justice O'Connor may have asked in her dissent in ASARCO, what's wrong with a system under which we just take all of the income of the corporation and we apportion it and we let the state tax a share of that? Isn't that good enough, really? And there's a couple of things wrong with that, I think. One of the things is that that method exalts form, that is, that there happens to be a corporation which is receiving this income rather than looking at the substance of the business activities. And that method does, in fact, invite extraterritorial taxation. Let me give an example to try to capture this thought. Suppose I have a business that operates beauty parlors in New York and New Jersey. There's no question that the income from that business can be taxed by New Jersey in accordance with some measurement of the share of that business that I do in New Jersey. Now, suppose I don't want to expand my beauty parlor business at present, and I decide to open up a business in California in parking lots, or to buy stock in a business in California in parking lots. I don't think it matters for this purpose. Now, suppose that in a given year, I make no money in New Jersey or in New York. The beauty parlor business is a stinker. I make no profit. The parking lot business, which is conducted in California, has nothing to do with the beauty parlors, is highly profitable. Now, under the notion that you just take all the business of the corporation, lump it together, and apportion it, New Jersey would end up taxing 50% of the income that I made in California. And that, I think, would clearly, in that hypothetical, violate the principle of avoiding extraterritorial taxation. New Jersey had nothing to do with the parking lots. Yet by apportioning my income in accordance with some formula, let's say that gave New Jersey 50% of my total business, it would be able to seize a share of the profits that I made from a business that I was not operating at all in New Jersey and tax them. Now, the problem that we're dealing with here, of course, is a problem of taxation of intangible income. That is,
just before you get away from your hypothetical, in your hypothetical, what was the domiciliary state of the corporation?
New York. I didn't mention it, but I'm.
Well, but in I take it under your proposal that New York could tax part of the parking lot business.
If the parking lot business were a separate corporation in which I own stock, New York could tax it. Now, but the principle on which New York can tax it is, I think, a totally different principle from the principle on which New Jersey or California could tax it.
Well, yes, but they could tax it. And under your submission to us, I take it in the ASARCO divestiture that we have here, the domiciliary state,
Michigan, all right.
Michigan can tax the profits that are made from that.
That is correct. We're not suggesting that it can't be taxed. That is not the question at all. The question is, may New Jersey tax?
And it seems to me somewhat odd under your system that Michigan can reap all of the benefits gain on disposition.
I don't think it's odd at all, because I think the principle under which Michigan gets to tax all of these benefits is the same principle that applies to individuals when they live in a state, the state in which they live, which presumptively, and in practice when you're talking about the commercial domicile, is the state that safeguards and provides opportunities and benefits for the generality of the operation, although not the specific details of it, has the right to tax all income wherever earned, except to the extent that it's being taxed someplace else and you may have to give credit under the Commerce Clause or under other principles. That is, if I live in New York and I make money abroad, let's say, New York has a perfect power to tax that, not because the activities abroad took place in New York, but because of a well-settled, long-standing recognition that proceeds from really a different principle, that the domiciliary state has the right to tax. I think you're asking the question the wrong way, because I think the constitutional question is, what has New Jersey done that would justify New Jersey? That is, what is the relationship between New Jersey and what it is that it seeks to tax? And if there is none, I don't think it helps New Jersey to say, well, the commercial domicile doesn't have all that much better a relationship. That is my response to the question. The alternative is to abandon, it seems to me, what the court has clearly held in a number of cases, both the sort of bedrock principle that there has to be nexus to the tax transaction, and then the principle that was developed in the mobile container line of cases that suggests that unitary business is sort of the benchmark. And let me say about intangible income that until, as I understand it, until 1960 or so, no one ever suggested that intangible income, dividends, interest, capital gains, was taxable any place except the commercial domicile or some other. That is, that income was always allocable to a single place. That's the tradition that's deeply rooted. Now you may say,
Was that true even then with respect to income from non-tangibles resulting from just short-term investments in working capital?
I think it probably is not true as to working capital. And I want to explain, I mean, I think the court in the mobile Sarco container line of cases developed a very coherent, tenable theory for understanding the question that is before the court today that governs the outcome in this case. But the unitary business principle, as I'm sure the court understands, is a notion that a single business conducted in many states may have different components. That is, you may have factories in one state, you may have stores in another state. They all contribute to the wealth of the combined business activity. And therefore, it is fair to look at those activities as a single business. And in the mobile case, where the court was dealing with dividends that Mobil earned from primarily Aramco, that is production in Saudi Arabia, it said Vermont could tax its apportioned share of that because, in essence, the oil production in Saudi Arabia and the ultimate sale of oil in Vermont and elsewhere were part of a single business. Vermont could tax its share. The court said that the linchpin of apportionability, the linchpin is the unitary business concept. That is, the way you go about deciding this is whether the businesses are unitary. Now, along come ASARCO and Woolworth a year later, and the court looks at those cases, and in those cases, again, you had an investment in various subsidiaries that produced dividend income and other income to the parent, and the question was whether Idaho or New Mexico, respectively, could bring that dividend income into the business that was being conducted in Idaho or in New Mexico. And the court said no. The court said, and I quote, "We cannot accept, consistently with recognized due process standards, a definition of unitary business that would permit non-domiciliary states to apportion and tax dividends where the business activities of the dividend payor have nothing to do with the activities of the recipient in the taxing state. Now, in this case, it is conceded that there is no relationship between ASARCO's business and Bendix's business. You would think that that would be the end of the matter. However, the New Jersey Supreme Court says on page 18A of the appendix, the tests for determining a unitary business are not controlled by the relationship between the taxpayer recipient and the affiliate generator of the income. So we have the Supreme Court saying one thing about as clearly as it could, the U.S. Supreme Court, the New Jersey Supreme Court in this case saying the opposite about as clearly as it could. Now, New Jersey says, it really, the Supreme Court can't literally have meant what it said in ASARCO. Why can't it have meant? Because it says, consider working capital. Working capital is an example of something, the income from which has always been treated as being part of the operating income of a business, taxable where the business operates, without regard to the fact that the bank or the United States government or whoever may be producing that income, paying those dividends or that interest, has no unitary relationship with the business. And that, of course, is true. We don't disagree with that. So we have this exception to the broad principle that was stated in ASARCO, and the court dealt with this exception in the container case, which was the last case in this series of cases. The court said there, as we made clear in another context in corn products, and I want to talk about the corn products case for a minute, capital transactions can serve either an investment function or an operational function. So what you're really looking at is, did this intangible asset that produced this income, was it used in an investment way or was it used in an operating way? If it was used in an operating way, then it's part of the operations that took place in part in New Jersey and that New Jersey may tax.
Isn't part of the problem of using that criterion that you never know for sure until the investment is closed out? I mean, you may have reasons for making the original investment, but in fact, the way you use it depends in part on the way you use the proceeds.
No, not at all. In fact, that's one of the, I think, great fallacies in New Jersey's argument, is that you should look at what happened after the investment ceased being an investment and became money, which might then be employed either in another investment or in the operations. I mean, this is the Martin Marietta thing. Our position is that it's quite clear that what you look at, you're taxing the current income. You're looking at whether at the time this intangible income was generated, it was being then and there used in some way, the intangible asset, in the operation of the business. So I don't think you have the problem. In fact, what I think you have from the mobile container line of cases is a very coherent rule. Let me just explain corn products if you're not.
Before you do that, Mr. Fry, would you comment a little, maybe you've already covered it more specifically, on what I understand to be the New Jersey Supreme Court's point that if you look at operations of the taxpayer, here, the operations, in a sense, were acquiring and disposing of businesses.
All right.
And that's what makes this case a little bit different from our ASARCO.
That is an exception that I would recognize. You could have a line of business, such as, let's say, a mutual fund would have, of acquiring and selling intangible interests. That could be your business. If that was your business, then the income would be business income, and the question you would ask in this case was whether the business of investment that was conducted, that line of business of Bendix, was conducted in part in New Jersey, in which case the profits from that business might be taxable. The record in this case is unequivocally clear that there was no business of investment. I mean, Bendix was as far from a mutual fund or anything like that as I can imagine. It is true that during, let's say, the 10 years prior to the ASARCO sale, it engaged in a number of acquisitions. Except for ASARCO, every one of those acquisitions was operational. That is, every one of those was a company that Bendix, that it either became integrated in Bendix's existing operations, as with Fram Auto Filters or Auto Light Spark Plugs and so on, the acquisition of those assets, or it was a line of business that Bendix itself operated. The only one that was a passive investment, which is a crucial concept here, was ASARCO. So if they were in the business of, that is, it's deceptive, and during this 10 years, I might add, there was only a single disposition. There were a lot of acquisitions. The acquisitions were operational. And I don't have a problem, and under the court's decisions, it's quite clear. If they acquire Fram auto filters in connection with their automotive business, they can operate it as a separate corporation and receive dividends, but the dividends that they receive will be part of their income if the business of Fram and the business of Bendix are unitary, which they would be in that case, because there's an exchange of values between those businesses.
Right. Was this, where did the New Jersey Supreme Court get the idea that Bendix really was in the business of buying and selling interests in other corporations?
I don't actually think that that is what it was saying, although what it was saying is somewhat ambiguous.
Well, what was it saying?
I think it was saying something a little different, which was that the investments that Bendix made, and it included the ASARCO investment in this, were functionally integrated or strategically integrated with the operations in terms of long-term strategy of the company. The company had a strategy of acquiring and divesting intangible assets.
Well, that isn't much different from what I said.
No, it's not.
That is the strategy of buying and selling interests in other business.
I think it's quite different. You can have a line of business which is investments. It's your businesses. You have a lot of people who spend their time looking for good investments.
However you put it, where did it get that idea?
Well, in part, it may have gotten that idea from New Jersey's counsel, although they sort of hint at it without suggesting.
Isn't that sort of a factual question?
It is sort of a factual question, but it is not a question.
Where did this case start?
Where did it start?
Yeah.
In the tax court. It started with an audit, followed by the tax court.
In the state of New Jersey?
In the state of New Jersey.
And then it went to, and there was a record made there?
There's actually a stipulated record in this case, pretty much. Uh-huh. There's a lengthy stipulation, which is in the joint appendix. Mm-hmm.
And it was, out of that, you think the New Jersey court concluded what it did from the joint stipulation?
I think so. I think so. But if
you win, we have to say they just drew the wrong inference from the factual from the stipulation.
Well, it's not clear what inference they drew. I mean, I do not believe they really drew the inference that Bendix was in the business of investments.
They purport to give a reason, and in order to us for to reject it, we have to know what it was.
Well, I think the reason that they give ultimately is the very
same. Or I guess we could say they gave no reason at all.
I think the reason that they give is, somebody once said that words are the outer shell of ideas, and the words that the New Jersey Supreme Court...
Who was that, do you think?
I'm not sure who it was. I thought about it. I didn't go to my
I think it was Felix Frankfurter?
Holmes. Got me. Holmes. All right. In this case, the words are the outer shell of no idea. The concept that the New Jersey Supreme Court was promulgating here has several difficulties. One is it's completely meaningless. I do not understand what they are talking about, except that it sounds to me like what they are saying is precisely what this court rejected in ASARCO.
In ASARCO, exactly.
Precisely what this court rejected in ASARCO.
Well, it sounds to me, as I read the state's brief in this case, it seemed to be arguing more from the dissent in ASARCO than the majority view.
Right, although much of the dissent in ASARCO I would not have to take issue with at all in order for there to be a reversal in this case. That is, in the dissent there was a substantial emphasis on the fact that ASARCO there was drawing upon its knowledge and expertise in the non-ferrous metals business in making its investment, that ASARCO had
a closer case there than here, perhaps.
Closer case there than here. And what I believe, there is a part of the dissent, I think, in all fairness, that suggests that the unitary business inquiry should essentially be discarded. But I think if the court made anything clear in that line of five cases, it was that the unitary business interest is the principal test. We have this exception for working capital, and the corn products exception was a situation where a company which surprisingly would produce products from corn was concerned about assuring stability in future prices, and therefore it purchased corn futures as a way of assuring that when it needed corn it would have the corn at a stable price. And the court there, that was a federal income tax case, but the concept that's involved is that that was part of the ordinary course of the operation of the company's business. and therefore was not a capital transaction that was subject to capital gain. So we have, I think, a very coherent concept that comes out of the mobile casino case.
Did Bendix ever return, include in its gross income for New Jersey tax purposes the dividends that it received from the SARCO stock?
It did include the dividends, and it tried...
Mistakenly, I suppose.
Mistakenly. I think it's clear...
Because you agree the same rules should apply to the dividends as applies to the capital gain?
The court made that clear in one of these five cases. I forget which one, but there was not a distinction. Let me just say that the key attributes that the court has looked at in deciding whether the dividend income is taxable are, first of all, the unity of businesses, and in the same line of business, is there a functional integration between the businesses? Secondly, the presence of control or potential control, which was crucial in SARCO and was a bone of contention between the majority and the dissent. There's no question here that Bendix had no control over SARCO. Thirdly, whether the investment is operational or passive. If an investment is passive, the court has thought of it as not being part of the unitary business. The court said in Container a unitary business finding was impermissible because the partial subsidiaries were not subject to even minimal control by SARCO, I was explaining the SARCO case, and were therefore passive investments in the most basic sense of the term. This was a passive investment. It was a place to park money that Bendix did not choose to use in its
operation. The Supreme Court didn't regard it as a passive investment.
Excuse me?
The State Supreme Court did not regard it as a passive investment.
Well, I don't think they would regard anything as a passive investment. I think if you apply their test, there is nothing. I think their test is precisely what SARCO rejected. And
I thought you said you couldn't tell what their test was.
Well, to the extent, I guess I could say that I can't tell whether they thought, although I think there's no basis in the record, that Bendix had a mutual fund business on the side in addition to its automotive and aerospace business.
Well, it's not a mutual fund business on the side, but they said that the chief executive, I guess he testified, didn't he? You said it was all stipulated.
He testified
at some length about his success in acquisitions. And
there wasn't a trial, but there was a deposition that was introduced, and it's clear. And it's clear, I think, in every case. I mean, that doesn't distinguish an investment function from an operational function for an intangible asset. Any $100 million investment, even if it's a pure investment, the chief executive of the company is going to think about it and make the decision whether to make it. The fact that part of the day he was thinking about the SARCO investment and part of the day he was thinking about the aerospace business doesn't make them unitary. Can't be, otherwise you've destroyed the concept.
No, but it may not be unitary, but it may be that that's a line of business. That's a separate line of business that the company's running, namely buying and selling interests.
Well, everything else that it did, I do want to reserve some time for rebuttal, but I'll just answer the question. These other acquisitions were operational acquisitions that were used in the business of the company. They were not investment acquisitions. They were operational acquisitions. This was a distinct, unique investment. It stands out like a sore thumb from all of these other items. And to say that because you had this unique transaction in SARCO, you had a business of investment, a line of business. And then how did that business get transacted in New Jersey? If you had a separate line of business that involved the purchase of SARCO, where is the showing that that line of business occurred in New Jersey? I would like to reserve the remainder of my time, if I may.
Very well, Mr. Fry. Mrs. Hamill, we'll hear from you.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I would like to just address very briefly some of the points made by Mr. Fry and then proceed with my argument. Mr. Fry states that the question to be decided is whether Bendix's investment in SARCO was an operational or a passive capital transaction. We agree with that formulation. That is the precise question, or one of the precise questions, and in our view, it was very plainly operational. Justice White, I believe, asked where New Jersey got the idea, the New Jersey Supreme Court got the idea, that Bendix was in the business of buying and selling companies. The record is very clear that from 1965, the point at which we started, we got the annual reports of Bendix, to 1982, when Bendix was essentially acquired by Martin Marietta, Bendix made 40 acquisitions, disposed of 11 companies, bought operating assets such as the Ford Motors, the Autolite trademark, spark plug and trademark, and bought the Asarco stock. Mr. Fry says, well, all those investments were operating control situations, all of them in the same, in related lines to what Bendix was always doing. It is true that those other acquisitions were acquisitions of the full corporate assets, the control of the company, but it is not true that they were all in the same lines of Bendix's initial businesses. 1965, Bendix bought the stock of United Geophysical Corporation. United Geophysical Corporation was in seismic surveying. 1970, Bendix bought the American Forest Products Corporation. Before that, Bendix had no...
Don't you agree that except for the Asarco acquisition, that those all of those other acquisitions, all of those other companies in which they acquired interests, either totally or partially, all of them could have been justifiably found to be a unitary business with Bendix?
Oh, no, Your Honor, absolutely not. When Bendix bought American Forest Products Company, it had no forest products business. It was a completely new venture, a completely new...
Oh, I know, but they stepped in and ran it, didn't they?
That's true.
Well, but they stepped in and ran it. It became part of their business.
That's absolutely true. But if you look at what you the court talked about in Asarco and Woolworth, where there are flows of value between Bendix Forest Products and what Bendix was doing in New Jersey, for instance, you would be hard put to find.
Well, I bet New Jersey claimed their share of Bendix's income from those.
It did, and those
subsidiaries on the grounds that they were unitary.
And Bendix didn't
object. Isn't
that
right?
That's absolutely right. And Bendix did not object to that. Bendix has not objected to the inclusion of any of the income from the operating businesses, the four lines of business, despite the fact that all that Bendix did in New Jersey was to operate the three units of its aerospace and one unit of its industrial energy.
Well, Ms. Hamill, it seems to me that both Container Corporation case and Asarco case, majorities, did look to operational ties, not just investment ties between the two corporations. I mean, the focus, it seems to me, of those opinions was that you're not going to be able to tax it under the unitary apportionment formula unless there are some kind of operational ties. Now, I was in the dissent in both cases, but I think you have to face up to the fact that those cases did look to those operational ties. And you don't have that here, do you?
Not the same way. But what we say you do have, Justice O'Connor, is a company that operated the way we believe many companies operate today, using its investments interchangeably with its manufacturing lines. When it sees the ability to earn money in the short-term money market, it will put the money there. When it sees the opportunity of diversifying into an area that's going to generate capital for another line, which was one of the reasons, rationales for the Asarco investment, it will go into that line. And the scope of the unitary business, which is what the court talked about in Container, is that entire business, one of aspect of which plays on the other, contributes to
You say
to the
then
other.
That for Bendix, presumably at one time making washing machines was just a means to an end of making money.
I know that what you're saying, and we're trying to say that we don't have to go quite that far. That what we're looking at is how these investments played with each other. The way that the CEO of Bendix viewed the assets of the corporation as pools of assets to be used interchangeably. And he wrote an article in the New York Times, which is in the joint appendix, stating that philosophy. That was his philosophy of managing this company. And we believe many corporations do that. We believe the problem, Justice O'Connor, with Asarco is we see that it just doesn't comport with any kind of economic reality.
Well, you don't have to convince me about the problem. I think you have some other people.
I'm sorry, I thought from your earlier question I did have to convince you. The problem with Asarco and Woolworth is the fact that we're put into a straitjacket of looking only at whether there are operating ties, control between the issuer of stock that generates a capital gain or a dividend or whatever, and the taxpayer operating in the taxing state. Control.
So it's the position of the state, and I take it of the state Supreme Court, that the position that it reached is in considerable tension with Asarco.
Yes, there's no question that we think Asarco was wrongly decided. We think it was wrongly decided for three reasons. One is this requirement of a relationship between the payor and payee of investment income, which really fragments the corporation. You go around looking for some relationship between Asarco and Bendix when we're not taxing Asarco, we're trying to tax Bendix. That's one problem. The other problem, which I think is related, is the inference in Asarco and Woolworth that, and Mr. Fry was really talking about this, that once you get by the nexus jurisdictional issue under the Due Process Clause, the next question is whether the income itself that you're talking about has some relation to the taxing state. And we believe that once you show that what's in the taxing state and what is outside the taxing state is part of a unitary business, if the unitary business principle means anything, you don't have to go any further, because we can't show, the majority of times, the state is not going to be able to show a direct monetary flow, a direct relationship between the investment and the state.
I guess I don't know what you mean by a unitary business. I guess, is every business that's owned by the same company part of a unitary business?
Yes.
Is that the only condition?
Yes. We would say because...
So there's really no inquiry to be made at all.
Yes.
As it's owned by the same corporation.
Yes, right. That's right. That is New Jersey's position. And I'd like to say otherwise. I'd like to tell you that we could say, well, let's look for an operational strategy.
And I would have given you a hard time, because I think you really are saying that anything owned by the... See, even the forest products business, for example, I don't know why they paid you taxes on that. Why was that? If Bendix had a forest in the Amazon, and that business doesn't contribute to its other automotive or aerospace operations at all, you would still consider that part of the unitary business, because it's owned by Bendix.
Yes, we would. And the very fact that we don't know why they did points up this problem. And without 237 interrogatories with subparts, 10 depositions, and a document request, we don't know why they agreed to pay us the income related to the forest products operation.
But they did.
That's
a California parking lot, isn't it?
Let me just talk. That's another point I wanted to get to. The California parking lot could perfectly well be unitary. In Butler Brothers versus McColgan, the court had quite similar situation with that was the wholesale distributing houses that operated in 7 states, quite fragmented. Operating loss in California, the taxing state. And the court says, well, but still, that those other businesses contributed to what went on in California, and they contributed because there was a central buying division, there was centralized management, and centralized ownership. So you go from the out-of-state divisions there to the central corporate control and management. And that's really what we're saying here, that once you have somebody like the Bendix Planning Department, the CEO of Bendix, William Agee, writing memos to the board saying, you know, we've got to grow in the 1980s. We've grown in the past. Growth has been and has been a strength for Bendix. The only way we can grow is to make acquisitions. We need money for aerospace. The way we're going to get money is we're going to invest in copper. There's going to be a worldwide shortage of copper. Copper prices are going to go through the roof. Asarco was simply a basket of commodities. You buy that stock, copper price goes through the roof, you sell it, and lo and behold, they tender for Martin Marietta, which is exactly what the strategy was.
Ms. Hamill, Surely the court must have had something in mind when it, in cases like Mobile, it says, well, if you're a unitary business, this kind of attack suggested that there were such entities as non-unitary businesses. You don't think there were any such?
Well, I could give you some examples of, or one example that comes to mind of what might be a non-unitary business, but the problem is this line drawing. And how is the court going to help this situation if every time to find out whether there's a unitary business, we have to go through the process we went through here? We have back in New Jersey, IBM, W.R. Grace, TRW, American Home Products, Mobil Oil,
Well, then you're suggesting not just that we overrule ASARCO, but that we go back further than that to cases like Mobil.
There's very serious problems with the record in Mobil as we read it. And there really was no evidence of the way the investment was linked to Mobil's operations, and so the court looked at operations. I guess what your question, though, Your Honor, is what do we do with the unitary business principle? Does it exist at all? And I think it...
I'd always thought it was in contradistinction to some other type of business, a non-unitary business. But you don't even need the word unitary under your analysis.
I'm really hard-pressed. Let me give you the one. Maybe here's an example. Say you had a company that goes out and buys company B, and company B owns the stock of company C. And C's business has absolutely no relationship to A's, and A didn't really intend to get C. So as soon as it gets C, as soon as it gets B, it sells the stock of C. There's no corporate strategy. There's no operational link. There's absolutely nothing, and it just turns the money over to the shareholders and says, okay.
Well, you wouldn't say, though, that that there's a unitary business between a company A that buys 6 shares of company B, and they will end up owning 0.001% of the company. Don't you at least have to, wouldn't you require to find it unitary that they at least have the potential of control?
No, Your Honor. Control makes absolutely
all right, so it
no
make,
difference.
It doesn't make any difference no. How much of a company they buy.
That's exactly
right. That's a unitary business.
That's right. Because the company is not, it just defies logic and common sense to say a company's going to go out and buy 20 shares, 30 shares of IBM for no reason, no reason connected with its operations.
Well, they want to make money.
Well,
they want to make money, and they think this is a good investment.
Well, but that's why they put money in. They put it in the short-term money market. They put it into Treasury bills. Everybody agrees Treasury income from short-term investments is apportionable because it's making money. It's a use of your idle cash. Mm-hmm. You can't distinguish between that and buying 20 shares of IBM.
Or paying $200 and some million for a piece.
May I go back to your forest products example, an entirely separate operation out in the West Coast? I can understand why they might include it on their tax return because it doesn't necessarily increase their tax because their base goes up when they include these other businesses too. Don't you have the three-factor formula where the land, assets, wages and all are part of the computation?
Yeah, but they're...
So it's possible that by putting in another business, you might actually reduce the tax because your base goes up.
No, because you're putting it into the
income
base.
What if you lost money out there, to take it an easy example?
Taking it and you had lost money? Yes, I suppose that's... Yeah,
and
that's
they'd get the benefit of all the assets in the formula, and they'd have a much lower rate of return on their income. But if it's totally separate, and there's no problem of accounting for the income from that and accounting for the business in New Jersey... The reason why the unitary business concept was developed simply doesn't apply. The reason for it was to take care of the case in which you cannot determine where the income comes from. And when you can determine it precisely, in our forest products example, I'm not quite clear on why it's so obvious to you that that's part of the unitary business.
Because
you have to ask the basic question, why do we have a unitary business concept?
Because it seems to me that once it's in the same corporate shell, once it's being managed by the same corporate management, There have to be flows of value. You have to assume that they're there. We can't delve into these facts in every one of these cases. It's an unworkable
proposition. You can't in every case, but the assumption that gave rise to the unitary business concept was that there were cases where you couldn't find out, and therefore you had to adopt some kind of a gross approach and then use a formula. But when you can identify the income precisely and without any problem of accounting, I don't understand why you even get to the
unitary. But Justice Stephen, I'm not sure that was the original formulation of the principle.
Correct.
I'm not really sure that's the way the court has been looking at it. If that were the case, a non-domiciliary state would never be able to tax dividend income because you'd always know that came from a separate payor. It wasn't operationally linked. You always know where it's coming from, that kind of investment income. You can always source it to a particular corporation. But
no, but you say it's part of the cash flow that they use in running the business within the state. It's part of the things that they rely on for operational purposes regularly.
But that's what we're saying in a grander scale with the Asarco investment, that it was part of this long-standing business function of growth and developing the Bendix company into a diversified manufacturer. The Asarco proceeds were intended to be used to get further into aerospace.
The business of owning a lot of separate businesses, but that just destroys the unitary business concept. I mean, if you say that you can be in the unitary business of owning separate businesses, there's no such thing as a unitary business concept. It's gone.
I think it's gone. I have to agree, it's gone. I mean, but you've got to do something that's economically real. And what we have with Asarco and Woolworth, it may be a bright line. Mr. Fry tells us it's workable. It certainly is workable. But it's just grossly unfair, and it really fragments the principle. We aren't getting a fair crack at these large amounts of investment income when companies are operating through investments. I mean, well, for whatever reason, investments are a very major part. I mean, Woolworth.
Domiciliary state can tax. It's not as though it won't get taxed. It'll get taxed. The question is whether New Jersey, simply by reason of the fact that one of the many separate businesses is conducted in New Jersey, should be able to tax on the basis of all of the other separate businesses. That's what I thought the unitary concept was directed at.
But then you're preferring the headquarters state simply because the company is there, this sort of notion of domicile. But why? That's not consistent with
the way
companies...
It's always been done that way. I don't know why.
Well...
if we were to agree with you and overrule Asarco or say that the unitary business concept is completely unworkable, would it follow that there would be double taxation so that the domiciliary plus New Jersey could tax?
Or would
we have to adopt a tandem doctrine saying that the domiciliary state is limited accordingly?
Is limited to what, Your Honor?
Is somehow limited so that there would be no double taxation.
There is a potential for double taxation. There's no question, because some of the state's statutory schemes give the domiciliary state the right to tax all so-called non-business income.
And I take it we have said that does not offend due process, or have we?
Well, I think there's some question, I believe it's in Mobile, as to whether, if that came to pass, whether you would necessarily prefer the domiciliary state over the states where the company does business and earns its income.
Let me put it this way. I take it there is no line of doctrine in our jurisprudence so far that would permit us to say that there could be no double taxation were we to overrule Asarco.
That there could be no double taxation? Well...
If we rule for you Bendix subject to double taxation once in New Jersey and once in the domicile, or does it have a due process objection?
I don't think it does. I mean, I think it's a question. It's a question for the next case when you really have the record to show if there's double taxation. It's remarkable, but that was not an issue in Mobile, not an issue in Asarco, not an issue in Woolworth, not an issue here. One begins to wonder whether a lot of multinationals locate their corporate headquarters in a state that apportions all income, which is the case with Michigan. Bendix apportioned that capital gain to Michigan and now claims New Jersey can't tax any of it. I think maybe that gets to the question of fairness. We are really just saying that since there is no double taxation, since overtaxing is about 0.75% of this gain, since Bendix was clearly in New Jersey to the extent of 8% of its net income, the three-factor apportionment formula in New Jersey yielded a percentage of 8%. It's just not unfair to permit us to tax less than 1% of this ASARCO gain.
Mrs. Hamill, there's another side to this, too. Let's suppose that the forest business is a good profit-making business, and let's assume it's in Tennessee or something. And Tennessee does not want to, and the other businesses of Bendix are not very profitable for this year. Tennessee says this forestry business is a totally separate business. This is not a unitary business. And we want to tax the forestry business on the assumption that it's all in Tennessee and we don't have to take into account the losses from the other enterprises. Can they do that or not? What I'm suggesting is that your everything is unitary approach does not always help the states. It sometimes helps them, it sometimes hurts them. Wouldn't Tennessee be hurt by that example I just gave?
If the forest price was in Tennessee and Tennessee wanted to tax it all.
They tax it all. They say, look, this business has nothing to do with, I know Bendix owns other businesses, but this business makes all its profit here. We don't want to have to apportion anything. We don't want to have to take into account the losses that Bendix makes elsewhere.
I think once you've decided that what is in the business is presumptively part of the unitary business, Tennessee would have to apportion. Tennessee could not then grab it all.
No, you'd say that. And,
yeah,
and,
I think that would be the result.
Well, I don't think they'd like that in Tennessee, and I don't know why they should have to pay for the losses in New Jersey. The whole business is just run out of Tennessee. It has no connection with the other states.
But again, you the same theory. I mean, our theory, if you bought into this theory, would say to Tennessee, well, you know, we're sorry, but you've got to apportion because constitutionally that's the rule. These businesses are truly indivisible. You just can't chop them up and say, okay, this segment of income is related to what Bendix is doing in New Jersey, but this segment of income is not. When William Agee and the Bendix Planning Department are managing this entire thing to diversify, to grow the company, let's talk also a little bit about the way Bendix...
Is that what New Jersey does? Does New Jersey tax all of the subsidiaries that operate in New Jersey on a unitary basis?
Let's be very clear about that. We don't use combined reporting in New Jersey, so we don't include the subsidiaries of Bendix, the income of the subsidiaries in the tax base. We take the dividends from the subsidiaries... And we say, under our statute, dividends from subsidiaries that are 80% or more owned, i.e. wholly owned or down to 80%, are excluded entirely from the base. Dividends from subsidiaries less than 80% owned are included in the base to the extent of 50%. Then apportioned using the three-factor formula. So Bendix, as it was going along with the ASARCO investment those 3 years, gave us 50% of the ASARCO dividends, applied its 8% apportionment factor, applied the 9% tax rate, and gave us that.
And they never asked for it back, I guess.
Well, they say they missed the statute of limitations, and then we point out also that they never complained about including the value of the ASARCO stock.
Maybe they got a new lawyer too.
They also included the value of the ASARCO stock in the net worth base of the tax. And they say, well, that's too small. They don't really have to worry about that. But we apportion net worth. It's essentially book equity just the way we apportion net income. They concede that they deducted the interest incurred on the borrowing to purchase the ASARCO stock against their unitary net income. They say they did that in the reply brief because the statute permits it. Well, the statute requires it. The statute also requires that they include all their income. And so I don't know where they get with that argument.
Do you think you can win this case without overruling ASARCO and this line of cases?
I think you have to overrule the principle in ASARCO. Mm. I think the holding, because of the enormous difference in the factual records here and there, I think you can stick with the holding.
Because what Idaho was arguing was very close to what we're arguing. There's no question that it was arguing that all of these investments contributed to the overall profitability of the company, but they just didn't have the record. It wasn't there. We didn't have the memos from William Agee. We didn't have a history of corporate acquisitions. We didn't have William Agee and another Bendix director sitting on the boards of some of the Southern Peru and MIM, or at least the record doesn't show it, and then making an offer to buy all the rest of the stock that ASARCO didn't own in Southern Peru and MIM. There was a very active aspect of this investment. Facts totally different from what you had before you in ASARCO. We obviously learned our lesson from ASARCO. I mean, we couldn't possibly begin to tackle, and so did Bendix. Bendix amended its position and began to dispute the includability of the ASARCO gain as soon as this court's decision in ASARCO and Woolworth came down. So I think you ought to be able to stick with the naked holding, but the principle you certainly have to reject. It seems to me. It seems to me that. I see my time is just about up. But it really may be time for the court to recognize and go back to fundamental due process principles that if the company is doing business in the state, the company is presumptively indivisible, that the state should be able to tax the entire income subject to apportionment. Problems will arise, and they should be dealt with through the apportionment formula. And I know, Justice Stevens, you talked in your mobile dissent about putting into the factors of the payors of the dividend income. We don't think that's the solution, because again, then you're looking at the activities of the other company. But one problem with the three-factor formula as it now works is that it doesn't include intangible property at all. It was devised for manufacturing companies. So the value of the ASARCO stock is not reflected in the property factor of the three-factor formula. The payroll and the receipts include a portion of the ASARCO. The receipts include the ASARCO gain. The payroll includes the management effort, whatever went into managing the ASARCO investment. But there is nothing in the property factor that reflects this enormous value which was contributing. It was not big enough to create much difference in New Jersey in this tax year, but in some years it can. I mean, you can have a huge investment portfolio that is generating 90% of the company's income, the way it was in Woolworth, the Woolworth case, and not have the value of that those assets reflected in the property factor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamill. Mr. Fry, you have 1 minute remaining.
All right, I'll try to speak very quickly then. The forest products business was included in the New Jersey return in part because actually forest products were sold in New Jersey, even though they didn't own forests in New Jersey.
They were
sold. Some of the products that Bendix made were sold in New Jersey. So New Jersey did have tax nexus over that part of the business. I thought that Ms. Hamill came close to admitting what I think is implicit in their position. ASARCO and Woolworth would have to be overruled, and the analysis of Mobil and Container would have to be jettisoned in order for them to prevail in this case. Now, Justice O'Connor, you said that she didn't have to convince you, but she should have to convince you, because as you pointed out in China, maybe you wouldn't have decided Aero Mayflower the way it was decided, but that doesn't mean you should change it. This is a viable system that we've had for a long time. The Uniform Determination of Income for Tax Purposes Act, UDIPA, addresses this subject, and it's adopted in many, many states. And it says that in order for the income to be business income and therefore part of the business and taxable, it has to be an integral part of the taxpayer's regular trade or business operations. This income clearly.
Thank you, Mr. Fry. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday next at 10 o'clock.